This week on Making Contact.
Cops can just do whatever they want because they say, you know what? My union is gonna back me.
Police officers and prison guards hold tremendous political sway. Their union support or opposition can make or break a campaign for office. And their advocacy for better pay, more power, and more jobs has been a major factor in the expansion of the prison industrial complex.
They go into a congressman's office and simply say, you need to support this House bill, this Senate bill that gives us money and keeps the mandatory minimums going, etc. And if you don't, we will tell the people back in your district you're soft on drugs, soft on crimes, and help you get defeated in the upcoming election.
For decades, they've helped build America's criminal justice system. Now, that system is changing. Can law enforcement unions change as well? I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. As the recession continues, states are struggling to meet costs. Formerly untouchable programs are now on the chopping block. In Illinois, Governor Pat Quinn decided to close two prisons, including the 500-bed Supermax TAMS facility.
I made a decision that I thought that the maximum, super maximum security mission of that prison was not one that we could continue and afford. And also, I think it could be done in a different way.
Human rights groups have decried conditions at TAMS and praised Quinn's decision to close it, along with several other youth and adult detention facilities. But prison employees mounted a campaign against the move. Kirk Dutton, vice president of the ASME union representing the prison's employees, says the closures mean the loss of 3,000 jobs.
I don't know what is going on in the state today that we would want to devastate the Southern Illinois communities who depend on these jobs to support their families and their livelihood.
Rick Hilliard is with the Southern Illinois Labor Council.
We reward our friends and we punish our enemies. Now, Governor, if you close the facilities and you keep jacking with our pensions and our benefits, you're looking an awful lot like one of our enemies.
Governor Quinn's response?
We are not building prisons or any center for the sole purpose of employment. We have to understand that the common good comes first.
Even Quinn's fellow Democrats are threatening him over the move. It's a glimpse of what faces any politician who dares to take on the powerful prison guard lobby in states across the country. The most powerful of them all is the California Correctional and Peace Officers Association, or CCPOA. In the past few decades, CCPOA has played a significant role in the expansion of the entire nation's prison system. Joanne Marr has this report on the rise of CCPOA and how this model prison guard union became a political force to be reckoned with.
CCPOA started in 1957 as a small prison guards union. But it wasn't until 1980, under a president named Don Novy, that membership began to grow. And grow from 7,500 in 1985 to over 30,000 today. And coinciding with the union's rise in power and wealth was the public's deep fear of crime in the 80s and 90s. Jonathan Simon is professor of law at UC Berkeley and an expert on mass incarceration. He says CCPOA made a strategic decision to join the tough-on-crime bandwagon.
What they ended up doing, basically, was defining themselves not primarily as workers, but as essentially victims, kind of the symbolic stand-ins for all of the potential crime victims in the state. And so prison officers were able to, in a sense, embrace that and say, we're the victims of criminals. We know how criminals think and how to handle them, so let's get rid of all these rehabilitative-oriented correctional elites and sort of put victims, and that means correctional officers, first.
California's maximum security prisons house some of the most violent inmates in the world, making it the toughest beat in the state.
CCPOA launched a PR campaign promoting the image of prison guards as gritty professionals who walk the toughest beat in the state. In the early 90s, CCPOA entered into a strategic alliance with two victims' rights groups. Crime Victims United started out as a small political action committee, funded almost entirely by CCPOA. But CVU has now grown into one of California's most influential victims' rights PACs. Together, CCPOA and CVU pushed a tough-on-crime agenda for longer prison sentences and harsher penalties. They strongly backed the Three Strikes Initiative in 1994, which passed by over 70% of the vote. Both groups endorse candidates, make campaign contributions, and lobby legislators. Harriet Salarno is president and founder of Crime Victims United. She can often be found wandering the corridors of the state capitol.
Coming up to Sacramento, I began to realize victims will not have any voice unless we partake in the legislative process and elect public officials that believe in public safety. I already lost my loved one, so I wanted to make sure that no one else would be in the same situation.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
The national anthem opens the annual Victims' Rights March and Rally, held every year at the state capitol in Sacramento. The gathering is sponsored by CCPOA and Crime Victims United. Prominent politicians from both sides of the aisle are in attendance, including California Governor Jerry Brown, who accepted an award from CCPOA in 2008, when he was then the state's attorney general.
Thanks for the plaque. I don't take it as any kind of award. I take it as a challenge to do more and to never rest until this state is truly safe. Thank you.
Given our current system, it's a little much to expect that someone's going to go up against these groups. Sometimes individual legislators did, but they did it at their own peril.
Dan McAlair is executive director of the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice.
When district attorneys would bring cases against, for example, guards who were accused of abusing inmates, they would go after them. They went after the district attorney in Del Norte County and the district attorney in Kings County. One of them they defeated. They did a mail campaign right up at the end and essentially accused him of being the coddler of criminals and a criminal sympathizer. That message was not lost on district attorneys at the local level. That was a very effective strategy.
Few politicians wanted to appear soft on crime for fear of losing elections. In the 80s and 90s, the California State Legislature passed over 1,000 bills imposing longer prison terms and more punitive sentences. The prison population exploded and at its peak rose from 25,000 prisoners in 1980 to over 170,000 in 2006. With its increased power and influence, the Prison Guards Union won favorable contracts year after year. Prison reform advocate Dan McAlair says even in bad economic times, CCPOA could count on receiving a raise.
In his last year in office, Gray Davis, when the state was in a recession and virtually every other area of state government was taking cuts, the CCPOA was awarded a 33% increase in wages. That's where they got it up to $70,000 after 6 years. So they make more than double the average of a prison guard salary around the country. That was at the height of their power.
With California's prisons at 200% overcapacity by 2004, conditions became unmanageable and intolerable. Inadequate bed space and health care were accompanied by reports of widespread prisoner abuse and excessive force by corrections officers. After years of litigation, Federal District Court Judge Thelton Henderson found that Pelican Bay State Prison was the site of, quote, a pattern of needless and officially sanctioned brutality.
One of the things that is just shocking to read that case now is that here you have a federal judge basically saying, I was being lied to.
UC Berkeley Professor of Law Jonathan Simon.
He went to Pelican Bay to visit it and witnessed a riot, which he then learned had been essentially arranged by the correctional officers to kind of intimidate him and to put the word in his mind that they needed to do whatever they needed to do to kind of keep these animals in place.
Move it.
During the past decade, the public's fear of crime has started to recede. The recession and California's budget woes mean that CCPOA can no longer count on the government for favorable contracts and the generous wage hikes of the past. The Supreme Court's 2011 decision requiring reductions in prison overcrowding may signal the end of the prison expansion era. In response to this changing landscape, CCPOA's positions on criminal justice policies have also dramatically shifted. Unlike its tough-on-crime stance of the past, CCPOA now supports prison reform. It's taken positions in favor of sentencing and parole reform, reductions in overcrowding, and rehabilitation.
We have been so demonized by outside groups. See, I don't have horns or a tail. I'm a regular person.
Chuck Alexander is vice president of CCPOA. Alexander says workplace safety is now a top concern for the union.
To get away from this warehousing is going to make it better for our members. Because right now, walking in a gymnasium with 300 or 400 inmates, and all you have is yourself and your wit and maybe one partner, that's not a good work environment for our members. It's not safe. It's very stressful. We've got nothing to lose by trying something different and everything to gain. Let's see if some of them are rehabilitatable. We're there. Let's give it a shot.
Corcoran State Prison, home to some of California's most dangerous inmates.
Started defending myself.
Struck this officer with his right fist.
He was spitting the blood into my partner's face.
CCPOA's own promotional videos have underlined the dangerous conditions inside prisons and the hazards faced by corrections officers. To alleviate overcrowding, Governor Jerry Brown's realignment plan is sending thousands of state prisoners to county jails. This shift will mean the need for fewer corrections officers, the possible closure of some prisons, and possible reductions in CCPOA's membership. Dan McAllaire, with the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, says CCPOA is now facing a temporary setback, perhaps a small bump in the road.
I think what's happening now is they are suffering from the successes of the late 1980s and the 1990s. They achieved everything that they thought they wanted, but they did it at great costs. They did it at the cost of working conditions for their members. They did it at significant cost to the state budget, to other areas of the state budget. It was just simply not sustainable. And now the new leadership is left to pick up the pieces.
Despite recent setbacks, the California Correctional and Peace Officers Association is not going away anytime soon. The hope of prison reform advocates is that the next generation of corrections officers will want to be more than just prison guards. Perhaps they can perform a more constructive, supportive role and make a positive difference in the lives of prisoners. At least that's the hope. For Making Contact, I'm Joanne Marr.
You won't find a guards union at all of America's prisons. That's due to the growing trend of privatization. Close to 10% of prisoners are now held in facilities owned by private companies, primarily two corporations, the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, and the GEO Group. To find out how those private prison companies are affecting the industry and criminal justice policy, we called up Alex Friedman, the associate editor of the monthly publication Prison Legal News. Alex, welcome to Making Contact.
Wow, thank you for having me on the show.
So, first of all, what are the priorities of companies like CCA, and what's been their lobbying strategy?
Well, these companies are very well established now. They've been around for decades, and they have a lot of money to throw around. So between CCA and its nearest competitor, GEO Group, the companies took in about $3 billion in gross revenue last year. And some of that money gets used to influence policymakers and lawmakers, and they do that through three ways. One is lobbying to ensure that their industry has lots of contracts and so forth. CCA, for example, spends around $1 million per year on the federal level alone. That's just one company in 1 year. Also, the companies make direct campaign contributions to political candidates, political incumbents, to governors, to both Republican and Democratic parties. And this amount of money is spread both in the states and on the federal level. It's fairly substantial. CCA reports most recently, I think, giving about $700,000 in 2010. That's the last numbers I'm aware of, to political candidates. The company has its own political action committee, or PAC. So they're very politically savvy. And the reason for that is because they rely almost exclusively on government contracts for their income, which is paid with taxpayer dollars, is taxpayer money. The third way that they influence the system is through what's called the revolving door. This is where they hire former public officials who then use their influence on their former colleagues who are still in government service. So, for example, CCA employs or has on its board two former directors of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. CCA also has on its board a former U.S. Senator, Thurgood Marshall Jr., and a number of other well-connected political figures. And this simply helps the company to advance its agenda before lawmakers and government agencies.
So how has this massive shift in the industry from public to private and those three aspects of lobbying you've talked about or policy influence you've talked about, how have those things affected policies related directly to inmates and to criminal justice in general?
Well, for one thing, the private prison industry has served to perpetuate the status quo in our prison system for decades, which basically means that it allows us to over-incarcerate. We are able to hold more prisoners than we have room for. So if a state prison system runs out of space, it simply has too many prisoners as a result of the state's, you know, very harsh sentencing laws or criminal justice policies, the state has several choices, one of which is the politically difficult and unpopular choice of revising its sentencing policies and changing its criminal justice policies or its parole policies, basically who we're locking up for how long. And while some of that might be very commonsensical, it's also very politically unpopular. Nobody wants to look soft on crime. So the other alternative is, hey, if we don't have enough bed space, we'll just contract with a private company and have them hold our prisoners, which has been the practice for the last several decades. So our government has not had to deal with those very difficult policy questions of whether we need to revise our sentencing laws, change our parole policies, alter our mandatory minimums, or make other improvements in our justice system to decrease our prison population. So it's really served to frustrate criminal justice reform.
And what is the relationship between the private prison companies and the prison guard unions? They do seem to share some legislative priorities, mainly that of keeping prison populations high.
Well, in some cases, that is possibly accurate. For the private prison companies, their goal is to make money. Simple as that. That's the only reason private companies exist, and it is the only interest that private prison companies have. They're not accountable to the public. They're accountable to their shareholders and their corporate executives. For unions, it's not simply about how much money they can make, but it's about the best interest of their membership. And that includes a variety of things, including pay, benefits, seniority, working conditions, health insurance, and so on. So their priorities aren't exactly the same. There have been cases where prison employee unions have advocated for laws that are harsher and would probably result in more people going to prison. There's also been allegations that private prison companies have done the exact same thing, that they advocate or have pushed laws through, for example, an organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, where CCA chaired their public safety task force for a number of years to develop laws that would put more people in prison, which of course would just benefit the industry. That isn't a large part of operations for either private prison companies or public service unions, but it is a disturbing concept where you have people who can influence our criminal justice system simply to ensure that their own private interests are met.
Alex Friedman is the associate editor for Prison Legal News. We'll link to some of his work on our website, radioproject.org. Alex, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Similar to prison guards, police unions have helped perpetuate cycles of criminalization and incarceration. In New York City, the police union is one of the biggest and most powerful in the country. But as Jessel Knorr reports, recent controversy over a law enforcement tool called Stop and Frisk has exposed some cracks in the union and may be opening the door for reform.
On June 17, 2012, over 15,000 New Yorkers, including labor, religious, and community groups, took part in a silent march to protest Stop and Frisk. The controversial practice empowers police to stop and search anyone they believe looks suspicious. But critics say it's used to racially profile. Blacks and Latinos make up 90% of the nearly 700,000 stop and frisks that took place in 2011.
What we are against is the NYPD, who has created an unconstitutionally blatant form of discrimination in their effort or their attempt to resolve and prevent crime in our communities.
Leroy Gadson is legal chair of the NAACP's New York branch, a professor of criminal justice at Queensborough Community College, and helped organize the march.
Whenever you have a productive relationship between the police and the community, what will happen, you will have a decrease in crime. We don't have that in Southeast Queens. The average young person, they hate the police.
Also taking part was New York State Senator Eric Adams. A retired NYPD captain, he's long been a leading critic of police policy and helped launch the organization 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care.
But what the higher-ups, particularly Police Commissioner Kelly, has done in New York City, he has told his commanders in rank and file that you're no longer going to use it just to determine if someone is committing a crime or have committed a crime. You're going to use it to gather the names and personal information of as many Black and Hispanics as possible. In essence, that's what they're doing, and that's what makes it wrong.
In response to the growing opposition to Stop and Frisk, the largest union representing New York City police, the Powerful Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, or PBA, has publicly backed the policy. The union's influence was on display during its endorsement of congressional candidate Elizabeth Crowley in the Democratic primary. Crowley seemed caught off guard when reporters repeatedly questioned her about her position on Stop and Frisk. Then PBA President Patrick Lynch whispered to Crowley, quote, support it as a tool. The embarrassing incident was caught on camera.
The least we could do is have some gratitude and be grateful for the work that they do.
So you do or don't support it as a policy?
Support it as a tool.
Can you state your question again?
Well, do you support the concept of Stop and Frisk? A lot of candidates in the city have come out saying that
I believe our police officers stop when they suspect that that there is somebody out there that is up to no good, so to say.
But while the PBA defends Stop and Frisk, even it has clashed with police leadership over the policy's implementation. The PBA declined requests for an interview, but speaking to New York One, its president, Patrick Lynch, said the police department illegally sets quotas for stops and punishes officers who fail to reach them.
The problem is when it's made into a numbers game. With anything, summonses or stop and frisk, if you put a quota or a certain number, it ruins that tool.
For some, the union's failure to end those quotas demonstrates the limits of its power. Others, like State Senator Adams, who is often critical of the union, praises its stance on quotas as a positive development.
To his credit, the president of the PBA, Pat Lynch, realized that this is bad policy for his members. That's the first step to moving towards true reform.
Some civil rights advocates, like Darius Charney, a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, says the union's stance on quotas does not address the bigger problems with New York law enforcement.
I mean, I think quotas is definitely a big part of it. It's by no means the entire source of the problem.
Charney, who is representing plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit against Stop and Frisk, says the police department needs a strong oversight body.
When you combine this huge incentive to just do stops at all costs with the fact that there's no consequences if you do them illegally, it really creates a recipe for, widespread violations of constitutional rights. And so, the accountability piece is something that the union, I think, is not going to get behind.
Critics like Charney also say stop and frisk have resulted in skyrocketing numbers of drug arrests. In 2011, more than 50,000 mostly black and Latino New Yorkers were arrested for possession. The racial disparity of such arrests in New York and across the country is one reason retired police detective Howard Wooldridge became a leading advocate for the decriminalization of marijuana. Now a lobbyist with the group Citizens Opposing Prohibition, Wooldridge says his main opponents in Congress are police and prison guard unions.
That's been my primary opposition here in Washington, the law enforcement lobby.
Wooldridge argues his former union, the Fraternal Order of Police, opposes legalization because it would result in budget cuts to law enforcement.
If we ended this drug prohibition, tens of thousands of FOP members would be laid off. Certainly tens of thousands would lose lots of the overtime that they make chasing a green plant, et cetera, provided either by the federal government or state governments for special narcotics units, et cetera.
Wooldridge says lobbyists for unions pressure politicians into supporting their positions.
They go into a congressman's office and simply say, you need to support this House bill, this Senate bill that gives us money and keeps the mandatory minimums going, et cetera. And if you don't, we will tell the people back in your district, back in your state, you're soft on drugs, soft on crimes, and help you get defeated in the upcoming election.
If it was legalized, a small amount, I would believe most of the people that are carrying it, right, wouldn't run from the police, wouldn't try to fight the police.
Retired NYPD Detective Carlton Berkeley.
And maybe we can prevent unnecessary and unjustified homicides as in Ramali Graham's case.
Ramali Graham was an 18-year-old African-American teenager who in February 2012 was shot dead in his own home by a member of the NYPD's Street Narcotics Enforcement Unit. Police say they believed Graham had a gun. No weapon was found, but police said they did find a bag of marijuana.
We don't like the racist. I said no racist.
Berkeley, a close friend of the Graham family and a member of 100 Blacks and Law Enforcement Who Care, says the unit responsible for Graham's death violated numerous protocols. The PBA, as they routinely do, strongly defended Richard Haste, the officer who pled not guilty to manslaughter for killing Graham. Berkeley says this is part of the problem.
Cops can just do whatever they want because they say, you know what, my union is gonna back me.
The city's police unions have long opposed or blocked efforts to increase police accountability. But after the police department was rocked by a series of scandals, the PBA's best efforts could not prevent passage of a new agreement empowering independent prosecutors to investigate police misconduct. But critics credit union lobbying with helping to water down the reforms and say they won't address the systemic racism within the police department.
You know, right now, the community feels it's a losing battle every time a situation like this happens, every time. And you know what? I feel the same way. And I'm a retired 20-year veteran. And I know for a fact that if the PBA, the DEA, SBA, these are all unions within NYPD because they're very strong, they're very powerful. You know, they lobby for everything that they want because they have a lot of money and they have a lot of influence.
Independent police oversight, electing a new mayor in 2013, and challenging stop and frisk in court are some of the parallel strategies grassroots groups are taking in New York City. There's agreement on one thing. It will take a true mass movement to make the NYPD and their union accountable to those they are sworn to protect and serve. For Making Contact, I'm Jessel Noor.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. This show was produced with support from the Puffin Foundation. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.